the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thank you for downloading the latest episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. I want to thank the listeners who support this effort, including James Balk, Louis Scolari, Leanne Rayer, and David Polson. If you want to join them, just go to my website, peterbcollins.com. For as little as $5 a month, you can take out a voluntary subscription. All the information is on the right-hand side of the homepage. One guest, one topic today, and at the end of this podcast, if it all works out, Will Durst has another scintillating commentary for you.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you. No pills gonna cure my ill. I got a bad case of loving you.
Doctor, doctor, doctor. Dr. Justin Frank returns to our program today. We first met him when he published Bush on the Couch several years back, and we've talked to him in the intervening years. And at last, he has published Obama on the Couch. Justin Frank is a psychiatrist, and he's a clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at George Washington University in D.C., and he maintains a private practice as well. But Barack Obama has never been on his couch and is not one of his patients. Justin Frank, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back. Well, I always learn more than you learn on these shows.
Oh, I don't know. I think it'll be a real good exchange today because you know a lot more about the underlying psychological issues that affect the president's public behavior. And I learned a lot from your book. It's quite instructive. And one of the things I'd like to do before we dive into your commentary and analysis is just briefly recap for people the very difficult childhood that he had, because I think that the separation from his real father, the ins and outs with his mom and the caretaking by his grandparents, a stepfather who was there for a period of time, all these are important factors in the president's psychological development. So let's start with what we know, and despite what Orly Tates or Donald Trump might say, Barack Obama was born in Hawaii, Honolulu, on August 4th of 1961.
Yes.
His parents had only been married for 6 months, and that's an issue. He was conceived out of wedlock. It doesn't quite make him a bastard, according to the dictionary definition, but it is a source of some embarrassment. His parents had a shotgun wedding, and he was born about 6 months later.
Correct. In fact, it brings up the very first kind of question that one can ask about him, which is that he discussed in his famous speech that really put him on the national map, which was his 2004 Democratic Convention speech in Boston, when he talked about how I don't see a red states and blue states, I see the United States. One of the things he talked about in that speech, and has talked about since, is the improbable love between his parents, between a black man from Africa and a white woman from Kansas. Well, I think it's an improbable love because it's improbable that it was love. And I think that that's something that's always been hard to talk for him, talk about for him. The idea that it was a shotgun marriage, that the father, literally, they hardly ever were together. They didn't live together for very long, maybe a month. And then that was it.
And Barack Obama Sr. was a bigamist. He was married, had a wife and child in Kenya at the time that he took vows with Stanley Ann Dunham in Hawaii.
That's right. He was a bigamist. And then he, then after she went away and went to Washington State, the University of Washington, with Obama when he was a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And then came back to Hawaii right before Barack Sr. graduated, and then there's this myth that he wanted to go to Harvard. Well, he did go to Harvard, but that he had got a scholarship that was enough that could take the whole family to NYU and preferred Harvard. But I'm sure it was because he preferred to not be with his wife, his Hawaiian wife, and with the baby.
Mm-hmm.
So he left, and he was actually thrown out of Harvard, deported for some kinds of behavior problems that he was having, and went back to Kenya. But, I mean, the main point is that he was not a real great guy in lots of ways. The mother, however, who was then really a child herself, she was 19, really spent a tremendous, made a tremendous effort to try to build up his reputation with her son, and spent a lot of time trying to improve how he was seen, to make sure that her, that young Barack had, who was called Barry, had a very positive image of African Americans, and felt really positive about his skin color, because basically he was a black skin color child raised in a white family. So that was the first thing about his childhood.
Yeah. Now, Dad leaves for Harvard, and then there is one other encounter between Barack Obama and his father in 1971. And when you add it all up, how much contact did the president have with his father during his entire childhood?
Well, that was the only real contact he had, because it's not clear whether he had any contact before that. In fact, he said in his autobiography that he met his father for the first time when he was 10.
71.
So I take that at its word.
And that was a visit that Barack Sr. made to Hawaii for about a month?
He made a visit to Hawaii right around Christmas time of 1971. So Barack had just had his 10th birthday in August. And the reason for the visit, in part, was the visit was facilitated by the fact that the father was recovering from a car accident that he had. And so he was unable to work. And so he actually arrived and was had a cane and to help him walk. And spent a month with Barry there. And they set him up in an apartment that was separate from where Stanley Ann was.
Because they had divorced by that time. She divorced him in about 1964.
Yeah, she divorced him in 1964, remarried in 1966 to Lolo Sotero.
Right.
And who was an Indonesian man, also very political and very almost radical in his political beliefs, who she met. And then she went to Jakarta with Barry when he was six. Lolo lived with the family for the 2 years before that with Stanley Ann and with young Barry. And he really was the only father that Barry knew, I think. In a deep way.
Right. And just to summarize briefly, Ann Dunham, Stanley was her father's name, and I'm sure she got a lot of boy named Sue jokes over the years, so I'll resist that temptation. But she went to Jakarta and took Barack with her, her son.
From 67 to 71.
Right. She and her son went to Jakarta. She worked for the U.S. International Development Agency.
Yes.
She also worked for the Ford Foundation. So
yes.
They were there together in Indonesia for 4 years. And then she sent him back to Hawaii, but stayed in Indonesia herself, returning a year later. And then she was there from 72 to 75 with Barack Jr., as he was in high school, and then she returned to Indonesia in 1975 with her daughter, but not with Barry or Barack.
Right, who she did invite to go with her, supposedly, and he said that he would rather stay with his friends and stay behind.
Right. And then the second marriage of Stanley Ann Dunham ended in divorce in 1980. She and Lolo parted then. And just to round it out, she died young at the age of 52. And Barack's father died in a car accident shy of the age of 62. So here is, you know, in thumbnail sketch, a very difficult childhood for him to traverse. And this, I think, is important when you start to analyze the very personal and intimate disclosures that he makes in Dreams of My Father.
Yes. First of all, I think the most important thing is what you just said, which is you called it Dreams of My Father, and the title of the book is actually Dreams from My Father.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that there's a big difference between those two things, especially since his use of that title, I think, is to obscure what was really there, which is that they are dreams of her, of his father, dreaming about his father and who his father was.
Mm-hmm.
But he talks about it as inherited dreams that he has taken on from his father, and those are the dreams that have to do with a united, with a world based on understanding, based on the triumph of reason, based on a place where people can really talk over their differences and learn about what they have in common, which was certainly his father's message as conveyed by the mother and to some extent by the father himself in his early days.
Mm-hmm. And the turbulence that we just described that he encountered as he was growing up, let me just say that nobody is really normal. Everybody has challenges and perceived deficiencies in their lives. And his rewriting of his own history and the messages that he picked up, mostly from his mother, some of it being transmitted on behalf of his absent father, these essentially amount to a rewriting of history in many respects. And I come from a family where my grandmother could not acknowledge the dark aspects of our family history. Everything was always perfect and rosy, and if she had written a book, I think it would have been a lot alike, similar to some of the kind of reconstruction that Obama did of his own personal history.
Yes. All I can say is yes. There's a reconstruction that is, on the one hand, somewhat glossed over certain problems. But on the other hand, it's a reconstruction that is at times painfully honest about himself and about his own shortcomings as a person growing up, how he was insensitive at times to the suffering of other people, etc. But the main thing that is missing in the book from, there are two things that are missing in his autobiography that that really struck me. One was any clear confrontation with his mother, any kind of anger at her, because she really did abandon him also. Several different times, and she put her career ahead of being a mother, I think, in many ways. That's the first thing, that he doesn't really address that directly except once, very briefly, when he's in high school, he writes about how he thought to himself when his mother was angry at him about not having studied, he thought to himself, you know, your experiment failed, Mom.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't say that out loud. At least he said that to the reader.
Yeah.
But he saw himself as her experiment. And the second thing I think that is missing in terms of a very clear picture is that he depicts how he can have very deep, profound emotions and nobody would know it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really struck by that story that he, and I spent a lot of time in the book on that, that he had a story that he told where he was 9 years old in Jakarta. He was reading through a Life magazine, and there was a picture of a black man that had disturbed him, and he looked at it closely, and it was a story about black Americans, Negroes, who are wanting to dye their skin so they can pass for white. And he was terribly upset by this. Of course, he writes this in his 30s, but looking back at it, he felt hot, angry, enraged, and very upset about the idea that somebody could hate themselves so much that they would hate their own skin. And I really think that's a profound idea, that he thought that. But what struck me was that after he thought that, he said he had this impulse to run and ask his mother and tell her about it, because she was working. It was in the library where she was working. And to tell her boss, who was himself African-American, ask him if he knew about this thing. And instead, he re-put the magazines back, and when his mother came to fetch him after work at 6 o'clock, he had just a calm smile on his face as if nothing had happened. And that's his strength and his weakness. But what it means is that he didn't have enough connection or confidence in his relationship to his mother that he would share with her what he was going through.
Dr. Frank, you also suggest in the book that Stanley Ann Dunham may not have been the Madonna figure that Barack Obama presents in most of his depictions of her. And after all, she chased men who were older, and I don't want to be racist about it, but it's a fair observation that she was attracted to men of color.
Yes, she was. And that was not... it's funny that I wrote about this in my book and had a sense of this, but really, it was much of that was unearthed by a biography of the mother by Janie Scott, who is a reporter in Boston, who did an extensive study of the mother and a history and interviewed over 200 different people who knew her. And there wasn't a lot of talk about the mother's sexual erotic life, but there was enough to make it pretty clear that the mother really did like men and went after them. She was certainly not a Madonna, but everybody's mother is pure in some way to the young boy. I can forgive him that a little bit. But I think what was striking was, again, one incident that she described in the book that I don't remember, I don't think I wrote about, but it was essentially that about maternal indifference, and it was essentially that a friend of hers was visiting in Jakarta around the time he was 9, and Barry was walking down the street. The mother was walking in the between Barry and this and her friend, so the three of them were walking down the street together. There were boys throwing rocks at Barry. And what I realized from reading that book, but also from just learning more about Indonesia, it's a very racist country, and racist against blacks and people with dark skin, which really came as a bit of a surprise to me. And they were throwing rocks at him, and the friend said to the mother, said to Stanley Ann, aren't you, you know, they're throwing rocks at your son. And she says, oh, that doesn't bother him. He can deal with it. Mm-hmm. These rocks don't bother him. Now, as a parent, I would be at least screaming at the boys to stop, especially if when my son's 9 years old, or I would be, you know, huddling him to me. But she was struck by the kind of seeming either confidence that Stanley Ann had in Barry, but I have to call that some form of indifference that is peculiar to me.
Yeah.
And I think they have what's called a dismissive attachment. He never talks about missing his mother in the book. He talks once about missing that he didn't have a father. But for the most part, there's not a lot about longing. But what he did long for, and the one thing he talked about longing for, of all the longings, and this is, I think, key to his adult life and his presidency, he was longing for a family. He came from a broken home, as you've said, as we've said, two broken homes. One broken originally when his father left, and then the second one when she left Jakarta with Barry and brought him back to Hawaii when he was 10. There was also a broken home there. And he never talked about missing Lolo, who was his stepfather, but what he did miss and yearn for was a family. He wanted to belong to a group. He wanted to belong somewhere, and he would do anything to belong to a group. He tells a story of in the fourth grade when he had one black friend in his school who was a young girl who he gave the name Coretta to, which is an interesting name to use, and gave her the name Coretta, and talked about how He was teased, and people, all of his friends were saying, "You're Coretta. Coretta's got a boyfriend. Coretta's got a boyfriend." And he pushed her away and said, "She's not my girlfriend," because he didn't want to be ostracized by these boys. So he was willing to hurt her, and I was thinking about that, not that I made that direct link, but you can see how he's pushed away his supporters in order to belong to a group, which is a group that is not interested in him, which is the many leaders of the Republican Party, especially John Boehner.
Well, and as a member of the professional left, I take great umbrage of that, Dr. Frank.
Yes.
Now, one thing I want to stress here is we have offered these observations about the parenting and family life of President Obama. And I think that your book is really well, its tone is really appropriate, Dr. Frank, because you offer these observations, but you don't move to judgment.
No.
And I think that's really important to stress for people who may be dubious about picking up a book of analysis of a patient that you have never seen. But I think that you do a marvelous job of marshaling information that is available on the public record and from the president's own expressions, and you look at them in light of his campaign and now his service as president, and you offer very interesting ways of us for us to interpret and analyze his actions against his background. But it is not a book of judgment, and you don't cross that line, and I, for one, am grateful for that.
Yes, thank you. I actually went out of my way because this is how I work as an analyst in my office and my practice, and applied psychoanalysis is not that different in certain ways, even though it's entirely different in others. The biggest difference, obviously, is that you don't have the patient in your consulting room. But it's interesting about that most Americans have accepted the fact, for instance, that Abraham Lincoln was depressed. And I don't think anybody treated him, there weren't even analysts in those days. So we do know about people's psyches, and this is an in-depth study of somebody's psyche. Non-judgmental. I don't judge. I do my best not to judge. I do have political biases because I am far more of a Democrat than a Republican, and I was far more sympathetic to Obama when I started working, shall we say, with him or on him than I was to President Bush. So that being said, however, I tried to be also objective with President Bush because an analysis is about a person's childhood, about their unconscious, about the factors that go on in their life developmentally, about their strengths, about their weaknesses, and, you know, about how they're how also they manage crises and manage conflicts as adults, and how that reflects their childhood. So, for instance, Obama, as a child, I think, yearned to have a family. It makes it almost too easy to think that, well, he became a community organizer because he wanted to get members of community that didn't get along to find a way to get along. It's a way of healing an internal family, healing his own family that never was, and also healing his biracial self by bringing these parts of himself together.
Well,
deep-seated drive in him.
And that's a perfect segue here, Dr. Frank, because I want to credit you with coining a new term that may not quite make it into medical dictionaries, but you describe the president as carrying obsessive bipartisan disorder. And this is something that has been infuriating for me, and I even reached the point, and maybe you have responded similarly, where over dinner and drinks a couple of months back, I had to concede to some of my progressive friends that if Hillary Clinton had been the nominee and been elected president in 2008, the one thing she wouldn't have done was cozy up to the Republicans, expecting that they were going to either like her or support her initiatives. And that is one of my regrets at this point, because I supported Obama because I thought he would be a break from the Clinton-Bush dynasty back and forth, and that I thought that he really would, he did have a clear idea of who the opponents are and what was needed to take them on and make change despite their obstructionism?
Well, being a bipartisan is not necessarily a bad thing. What makes obsessive bipartisan disorder a disorder is refusing to accept that there are a large group of people, including Boehner and others, who are not interested in being bipartisan at all and who are not interested in working out an agreement at all. And I think that his lack of real reality testing, if you will, where Hillary Clinton did understand, I mean, she's the one who talked about a vast right-wing conspiracy.
Yeah.
when the Monica Lewinsky thing came out. She understands this, although she did go to breakfast with Rupert Murdoch, as I recall, a few years later.
Yeah. Now, but, let me read a quote from Obama on the couch.
Okay.
Obama's tenacious hold on his belief in the illusion of common ground indicates that it functions as an idée fixe, that's a French term, a fixed idea, a guiding principle he clings to regardless of evidence to the contrary. In this respect, rather than the pragmatist that he presents himself as, he is truly an ideologue, albeit in pragmatist clothing. But the belief that we are fundamentally more united than divided serves as a blind spot for him as well, undermining his efforts to foster a unity that could be realistically attained. Thus, he courted Republican votes for health care reform for so long that he began to lose support among his Democratic base. And that's an understatement.
Yep. I agree with that.
well,
I agree with that quote. And I think that the thing that's so stunning about it is that that's persisted and persisted, and that even after he announced the day of his speech announcing the assassination of bin Laden, he ended up with another bipartisan kind of thing. At the end of that speech, he is obsessed with getting along, and it blinds him to the destructiveness. Now, one of the things that's of many of the Republicans who are just dedicated and devoted to destroying him and destroying his presidency. Now, the one thing that we have in common that he doesn't mention as human beings are things like cruelty, greed, envy, all kinds of things that are not necessarily so pleasant. Those are also things that we as human beings have in common to some degree or other. And in fact, one of the most important, we used to joke about it in my residency at Harvard, that one of the main criteria for being accepted into the program was for the residents to be able to be aware of their own sadism. Because you have to be aware of certain kinds of cruel aspects, of ways you could be that way. And not that you want to act on it, but that you know about these parts of yourself. And there are some really very healthy religions where they do talk about those kinds of things. But in Obama's case, I think that he's gone out of his way to not accept that that's part of what we have in common. So when Freud wrote Civilization and Its Discontents, the reason he wrote it was that we have to have laws. And the reason we have to have laws is to protect us from ourselves and each other. Because it's normal to want to have what maybe somebody else has and want to take it. And it's natural. It doesn't mean... So civilization is actually a source of depressive frustration for many people. and it can be great, but it also has a cost. And I think that that's the part that Obama, who's a law professor, doesn't seem to remember when he's the president. He is so devoted to looking at what we have in common and what is a good that we have in common that he really is blind to the destructiveness. In fact, at one point, and I did also write in the book, that there was a time when he was interviewed by Bill O'Reilly, and Bill O'Reilly asked him, this was right before the Super Bowl, he granted an interview with him, how does it feel to be hated? And Obama said that, lots of presidents like Bush and Clinton have been disliked. It's always, that's common. And O'Reilly cut through that and said, I didn't say disliked. I said hated. And it was a very dramatic moment that is O'Reilly at that moment went way up in my estimation of him, because I felt like he was doing something that I would have done had Obama been in my consulting room. I would have cut through the denial.
Well, your next book should be O'Reilly on the Couch.
I don't want to spend that much time with him.
I'll yield to your point that he had a moment there.
He had a moment.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole point. The idea about finding things that a bad person can do that is good or useful is hard for us to accept, too, if you're, you know, on one side of the spectrum. I mean, that's always an issue.
Dr. Frank,
Obama, that's what he tries to address, but unsuccessfully.
Dr. Frank, it appears your book was just about to go to press when the president announced on May 1st that Navy SEALs had taken out Osama bin Laden.
Yes.
And it really changed the book. You really adjusted the manuscript in many places, including at the end, because it caused you to recalculate. And I'd like you to take a moment here to talk about, as we come out of his obsessive bipartisan disorder and this deep-seated need for unity, you made a powerful comparison regarding his decision to assassinate bin Laden. And it essentially boils down to he's able to go to the jugular, for the jugular, on a stranger, on an enemy. But he can't seem to do that, even figuratively, with the political opponents who have publicly declared their desire to kill him politically, to just wipe him out. And this really changed your assessment in a couple of ways. Please describe.
Well, first of all, it reminded me of one of the reasons I wrote the book, but it did change my analysis. What it reminded me of was there was the And I wrote the book because there's a huge difference between Obama the candidate and Obama the president. Obama the candidate in 08 really was sharp, aggressive, assertive. He put down Hillary at times. He was able to just be aggressive, and he was aggressive against McCain. And clearly spoke up in ways that, you know, got a lot of support because he was against, you know, torture and all the different things and the abuses of the Bush administration. But then he became President Obama, and he developed this bipartisan disorder that came up to the front. And I have a chapter where he's like the accommodator-in-chief. So when it was announced that he killed bin Laden, it was really important to think about the fact that he can be determinedly aggressive. In fact, I saw that some of his... The determination of having bin Laden killed and the way he did it is actually not that dissimilar from his stubborn determination to try to get along with people who were out to get him, like the Republicans. It's actually a stubborn determination to have a relationship with people who hate you. But that's a very... It's disturbing and hard to put my... You know, hard to really completely... this is an analysis, by the way, that's in medias res. I mean, he's only in his third year when the book came out, and we'll just have to see how he evolved. But I think that his decision to kill and the evidence of that caused me to actually... I was going to send in the transcript the next morning, the book, the manuscript, and I called my publisher. I said, I can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, also, you took a look at the bin Laden killing... and looked at the influences of Obama's parents and, to some extent, the stepfather Lolo on this process. Explain that, please.
Well, one of the things that Lolo did was Lolo really did teach him, his stepfather, about being stronger than your enemies, that he was very much focused on protecting yourself, on defending yourself, and on not letting other people know what you're thinking. Lolo taught him about never flinching, never showing weakness, and you can always, if you're not strong enough to do it yourself, you should get someone who is stronger than you who can take care of things. I think I'm not sure if that's what you had in mind.
Yeah. Yeah, and also you...
Lolo, and he taught him to just not say anything.
Right, you also felt that he was rejecting the soft side of his mother in making this decision to pull the trigger.
He was absolutely rejecting the soft side of his mother. He was very clear about that. And it's so interesting because some of the Republicans, and when you mentioned earlier that I was on a radio show, conservative, I've been on quite a few conservative shows, they all seem to be interested in how he has this empathy for Ahmadinejad and he wants to talk with them, and they keep talking about that and Raul Castro, and that's ridiculous.
Huh.
But that's the part of him that does sound like his mother. He's actually able to kill. And he can shake your hand, and you don't know that he's going to kill you because he's that able to do it and that able to split off and disconnect. He has like a capacity when he could give all those humorous jokes in the White House Correspondents' Dinner that night while the Navy SEALs were out trying to get bin Laden, and he knew it, is really quite an amazing feat for somebody. It means that he can really be in more, he can be in more than one state almost at the same time.
But I have concerns about this detachment and what it can lead to. When I heard the news about the killing of Osama bin Laden and the shifting versions of events that came out of various White House and CIA spokespeople in the week afterward, it concerned me a great deal because of a lack of process. We never charged, indicted, or convicted Osama bin Laden. It was purely consensus based on propaganda. And I'm not saying he was a good guy. I'm not saying that I identify with him in any way. I'm just objectively observing that we didn't follow our own procedures for identifying a culprit and then so-called bringing him to justice. And while most Americans had no questions about that, then I raised this in June. We had targeted Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen living in Yemen, for execution. It's the killer capture list. And the president has coldly not only executed Awlaki without charge or trial, but his two teenage children have been killed by drone strikes, subsequent drone strikes in Yemen. And I'm very concerned that the transformation from Obama the candidate, who was going to change the mindset that led us to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, who was going to close Guantanamo and end torture. Well, he tried to close Guantanamo, but he's kept open black sites in Afghanistan, and we aren't even permitted to know who is being detained there. And so the cold and calculating side of Barack Obama that you identify with the bin Laden episode concerns me a great deal as it applies to other issues.
Well, I agree with you. He has a cold and calculating side, and it does not come out except in these moments. And at one point, I really feel that one of the things that can happen to a person, I'll just go back to the earliest childhood, and I haven't really talked about this enough in the book even, and that is that there's something called dismissive attachment, that when you're deeply attached to somebody and they disappoint you or they hurt you, you dismiss them psychologically as if they don't matter. You sort of kill them off in your mind. You eliminate them as people that you need or as people that matter. You know, there's a common saying that we all have that saying a little bit, you know, oh, he's dead to me or whatever it is. Well, dismissive attachment is one way that children have, some children, of managing abandonment and loss. Others protest, scream, yell, run after their parents, whatever it is, but they don't just deny the attachment. This is a boy who, when he was a boy, who denied his attachment to his mother in a certain way. He never protested, and I did write about that a little bit. He never said to his mother, what's more important, a boy or a remote Indonesian village? Mm-hmm. That would have been a thing that most children would say who have a strong attachment. I think that that cold, detached quality can allow him to kill as long as he doesn't know the person. I think that he cannot bring a person to trial and then kill him, have him killed after that, because he'll see their humanity. He really needs to keep it split. I'm sure that bin Laden was buried at sea psychologically, the reason has to do with not wanting any kind of sympathy for him at all.
Well, Dr. Frank, I just need to inject here, and I won't try to transfer my politics to you, but I think that the way they took out bin Laden was to protect a lot of blowback secrets from the past. His role in Afghanistan in the 1980s and whatever happened in the intervening years up until 2001 is pretty much off the books, and they want to keep it that way.
Okay, now this is where you are adding a deeper level, or not a deeper level, but a different level, that one of the weaknesses of psychoanalysis is that it doesn't take into account enough of what you're just saying, which is that it is a wish to silence so nobody will know how much money we had given bin Laden in the past, how involved we've been with him, how much we supported him in Afghanistan against Russia. All of those things, I agree with you completely. And I didn't address those things because I was really trying to look at the psychology of Obama. But what does fit in with what you're saying, still, and keeping it psychoanalytic, is that he wants to turn the page. And he wants to turn the page on his own hatred. He wants to turn the page to the extent that he will not prosecute George Bush. He wants to turn the page that he will not prosecute any of the members of AIG or any of the government, any of the people who were criminals like Dick Cheney. He will not do that, because he does not want to look at his own past. He does not want to stir up feelings that would lead to de-idealization of his parents.
And
he's
not
going to let that happen. So I agree with you from the political point of view.
Mm-hmm.
You're even more right, and what you're saying is more important, because it's like shutting up somebody so they won't spill the beans.
And on what you were just describing there, I get so frustrated. I find that phrase, turn the page, to be extremely condescending.
Totally.
And the idea is that he's the preacher, we're the choir, and we're going to turn the page, and we're all going to sing the same song next because I said so. And this leads to the best chapter title, at least that's my nomination, Chapter 5. The only thing we have to fear is change itself. I give you a lot of credit for the juxtaposition there. But
I like that title, too.
What you described there, Dr. Frank, is the way he has turned on his base. And this is a dismissive attachment. I'm not qualified to make that analysis, but it appears that way to me.
Yes.
That we've become baggage to him. The people,
yes.
The people who made the difference for him in Iowa, the people who were along with him on the contentious primary battle with Hillary Clinton, and who stayed with him because primarily he was against the war in Iraq. And that was the rallying point, among others, that really drew people to him.
Yes.
And he has now decided that we are non-essential. And Axelrod has a plan for him to get reelected without us. I don't see those numbers, but I'm sure there's a scheme somewhere.
Well,
and
we're not essential. We're irritants.
Okay.
And that's what really bothers me. And the thing is that if you really are the one thing that that I didn't explicitly say in the book, but that a friend of mine who read the book explicitly said that he got from the book, is the theme of seduce and abandon. It's there, but it's not really clearly stated, and that is that Obama, as a child, was seduced by myths about his father. He was seduced by the intense involvement of his mother, and then abandoned. He learned about being seduced and abandoned, and he became a person who does it rather than has it done to him. He became a seducer and an abandoner. And one of the things that, and that's why he was actually susceptible in a way, in part, to Boehner. When they talked about the grand bargain and could play golf, Boehner actually seduced him into thinking he would go along with him, when he never was going to go along with him, ever. So the seducer gets seduced.
Well, and it's very interesting.
One of the things, just to stay with his point, though,
go ahead.
What he's done with the left is that why we become irritants to him is that there's an unconscious guilt towards the people you've abandoned because you know you've hurt them. And he writes about that in his book, how he abandoned. I mean, his thing about this girl in the fourth grade, Coretta, who he betrayed, she could be just as easily you and me from the left, who he betrayed in order to belong to a group of Republicans and get along. The fact is that he felt very guilty eventually towards her. And I think that one of the things that happens is that if we criticize him or say, keep your promises, you promised you were going to close Guantanamo, you promised you were going to, you know, have transparency, he hears those not necessarily as urging him to continue, to help him, to give him strength. He hears them only as destructive attacks, and that's because he feels guilty.
And Dr. Frank, there's so much here. He cannot be unaware of the people who are camped out in public places and marching in the streets, challenging Wall Street because he failed to.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Recently he denounced Bank of America for its heartless attempt to impose a $5 a month fee on debit card users. And I supported him in that rejection. But it pales in comparison to the crimes of Bank of America. And
totally.
he is there, facilitating their continual fleecing of the American people. More people are projected to be foreclosed on in the next year. And, his attempts to deal with it are so limited, and we know it. That's the real angst that is being expressed by these kind of leaderless, non-explicit demonstrations. And I'm sure that he gets it on a certain level, but how could he have gone to the Congressional Black Caucus at the end of September and lectured them to put on their marching shoes and shut up and stop whining when he failed to honor his pledge to put on his comfortable shoes and march with labor if it was ever under assault? He hasn't been to Madison, Wisconsin, and he only mentioned the struggle that labor is facing on Labor Day this year.
Well, first of all, I don't want to be too reductionistic because that's the danger of psychoanalysis, but I have to be a little bit reductionistic here, and that is that he was doing to the Congressional Black Caucus what his mother was doing to him. Stop whining, Barry. You have to do this. Stop whining, little boy, about having to do your homework. You have to do it. And then he was also mirroring his father, who said, turn off your TV, boy, and stop whining. And he had already done his homework. And the father said, well, do it for next week. That's in the book. So what he's doing is he's reliving and taking it out on his deepest and clearest supporters, because he is replaying this kind of parental, terrible situation where he is demeaning in ways that he felt demeaned the very people who love him the most and want him to succeed, the way he loved his mother and his father the most and wanted them to be back together.
And those,
but he felt demeaned by them.
But those emotions are trumping the seducer role. Because
yes.
the very people who he needs for his reelection next year are the people who he is stiff-arming.
Well, he'll start seducing again. He'll go back and forth. Because I think that the problem with having a mother and father the way like he had is that the mother and father sometimes are him, and his followers are little Barry. Other times, he's little Barry asking for their help. Please help me. And they become the critical mother who are saying, you're not doing your job right. So sometimes he's the one who's saying to the Congressional Black Caucus, you're not doing your job right. Other times he's hearing people on the left who he gets angry at who says that he's not doing his job right. It goes back and forth because the mother is a hot potato and they don't know what to do with her. I agree with you about seducing and abandoning, however, and I think that he is now trying to seduce the left by being tough. And the one thing I did suggest in the book he seems to be doing more of, which is naming names. When he was criticizing Congress before 2010 elections, he essentially seal the fate of a lot of supporting constituents and supporting congressmen who had gone out of their way to support him. He just let them dangle and lose. And I think that now he has to really name the fact that it's certain members of Congress. It's not Congress that's dysfunctional. It's things that are being blocked regularly, and nobody knows what to do about it. That's true.
Well, Drew Weston published what I think was a pivotal piece in the New York Times, July, I think it was, or
yes,
early
it was
August.
A great article, yes.
Where he really dinged Obama for his failure to establish an appropriate narrative at the beginning of his presidency, and it deals with the name calling that you just described. He needed to talk about the Republican deficit. He needed to talk about the failed Bush economic policies, and he would refer to it indirectly. Oh, you wouldn't believe what was on my desk when I got to the Oval Office. But he couldn't bring himself to say Bush and Cheney screwed us. He used the metaphor of driving a car into a ditch during the campaign. But once he was elected, and this is part and parcel with his refusal, I think it's criminal, to investigate and prosecute wrongdoing under Bush. Bush and Cheney in their books have admitted to torturing and to authorizing it. It's clearly actionable information. And here, Barry turned the page, Obama says it's optional. The Constitution is an optional document, and the rule of law is optional, and he gets to make that decision.
And what I'm saying is the reason it's optional, one of the main reasons, stems from his wish to keep rose-colored glasses on about his own childhood, even though it was tough and he was tough. When he can stand there and say his parents had an improbable love, or when he can stand there and not confront his mother or his father, who was frightening his father, this is what we're dealing with. This is a person who's not able to go into things, and it's almost like the book was his autobiography was like an attempt to do it and yet make it, put it to rest. It's done. And not look at it any more deeply. And I think that that's what you're talking about. He really did say those things when he was campaigning. He was very clear. He was clear that the Republicans had driven us into a ditch. He did not build a narrative, that's true, but I don't think he could build a narrative until he understood his own narrative. He was driven into a ditch and had to become a community organizer and had to go out of his way to have bipartisan disorder because he had to belong to groups because he felt like such an outsider.
Dr. Frank, here's another quote.
Very painful.
Here's another quote from your book. To some extent, the process is replayed with each sitting president. He represents parts of us that we split off and project onto him, a process that ultimately influences how we perceive and experience him.
Yes.
But Obama's not being known, this is during the 08 campaign, allowed observers to project parts of themselves onto him with more ease than any other presidential candidate. All of the 08 Democratic candidates were better known than Obama, who often joked about being unknown, a skinny, dark-skinned man with a funny-sounding name. Candidate Obama offered an element of the unknown that invited narcissistic identification, perhaps as a means to fill in the blanks and assuage our anxiety. And Dr. Frank, this is what I thought the very first time I heard him speak. I was in Washington in 2007 for the, it was called Take Back America Conference. And within a period of 2 days, all of the contenders spoke. Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, Speaker Pelosi was there. She's not a candidate, but she was one of the people who spoke. They were all blown off the stage by Barack Obama, who didn't come in and talk about Senate Bill such and such or a specific policy. He came in with a very powerful overarching narrative. And I sat there and I said, what a blank screen. I can see people projecting onto him because what he did is very skillfully identify problems without really proposing any solutions other than hope and change. And this permitted people who supported single-payer health care to say, he's my man. Even though the second time I heard him speak was at the Families USA Healthcare Conference in Washington, where people from Illinois tipped me off that he was originally a single-payer guy, but he had switched while he was a member of the state Senate in Illinois. And that was a very critical factor for me in understanding the way he could speak in a skillful manner that would permit us to imagine that he was actually speaking to our specific ideas and positions. And despite that, I steeled myself, Dr. Frank. I lowered my expectations as a result. And I'm still disappointed because my lowered expectations were that this former constitutional law instructor would return us to constitutional rule and the fundamental rule of law. Those were my expectations, limited to that. And yet I'm still deeply disappointed by this man.
I agree with you. I mean, he is a person who has decided to be a cipher and a blank projection screen, and that at one point I thought that that the reason why people didn't understand his use of the term change is because they didn't understand that he actually did mean change, but not the change we thought he meant. He just meant change into being able to listen to other people and respect and bring people together and see this overarching shared vision of his, because he thought he could be a community organizer for the United States. It's like the firstborn child wants to stop parental bickering by thinking that he can be the mediator in a parental fight. Well, you can't when you're a child, especially. It's hard enough for me as a couples therapist to be a mediator in a couples fight. He really can't do that, and yet he presented himself that way in order to get elected. He also knew, I think, and I'm assuming you agree, that he knew this was the best chance for a black to get elected president, mm-hmm. because so many people hated Bush, and that would trump their racism or their disinclination to vote for a black man or their disinclination to vote for a woman. I mean, this was the one chance in the near future because people just hated Bush. I think that he knew that, and I think that he wanted to get as many people possibly seduced as possible, and he's always done this. He did this to become the head of Harvard, to be Harvard Law Review. This is what he does, and it has to do with this seductive mimicking of the fantasy of his father. His father, the story that's the organizing myth in Dreams from My Father, and it's from my father, the organizing myth in that book is the one that Gramps tells about going to a bar with the father, and the two of them are in a bar where the father is the only black face in a white bar, and one of the people at the bar drinking makes a racial remark, and the bar gets hushed, and it looks like there's going to be a huge fight between Obama Sr. and this guy. But instead, Obama Sr. walks up to the guy and talks about how destructive racism, how terrible racism is. It not only demeans the person who's the victim, it also demeans the racist himself. It interferes with thinking, with cooperation. And the guy was so moved by Obama's speech, apparently, that he bought everybody a round of drinks. Well, that myth was what he was fed, which is the triumph of reason over hate, the triumph of reason and reasoning over destruction and hate. And that's just wrong. The guy was willing to listen for some reason, but that's where he comes from.
Dr. Frank, the projection, the seduction by Obama played out differently for different people. And I just want to cite my friend Nancy Walton. She and I worked in radio together for a number of years. She lives in Missoula, Montana. And when Obama campaigned there, she managed to, and I'm not referencing anything beyond the rope line, but she pulled a Lewinsky. She got right up there next to him. No skirt chasing was involved. But she had a 10-second encounter with him, and she told him that she loved him. And I want to ask you about this in particular because you do address it a little bit in the book. There are people who went beyond just political projection and really developed a kind of voyeuristic or some sort of relationship in their own minds with this candidate.
I've never had an experience like this. I would say that there are many of my friends, my women friends, said to me when they knew I was writing this book, be nice to him. Don't be hard on him. I love him. I've never heard anything like this. He invites a maternal transference that people have to him that involves a wish to take care of him and protect him, that he's a skinny kid, that he really tries hard, that he's so earnest and so special, and he's got his big ears and that winning smile, that they want to take care of him. The two people who gave me book parties, two of my close friends, both would not give me a book party for this book. They gave me book parties for the Bush book, but they didn't want me, they were women, they didn't want to be linked with the possibility that I would be doing something that would be hurtful to their man. And that fits with your friend.
Yeah.
It's really shocking to me. And I think that people feel very taken in and adoring of him in a way that is like quite striking. And I think that he was able to do this also as a seducer, just what we were talking about before, because he has this ability to get people to like him. I mean, for this guy Lawrence Tribe, I think that's his name,
yeah,
how you pronounce it, to say that he was the best law student out of 30,000 law students he'd ever taught at Harvard, I mean, that's pretty unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, he is smart, but I mean, I can't understand that where he got that from, except that there's a way in which he can be so seductive that he speaks on your level, and you really feel like you're his one and only when you talk to him. And my friends who have known him have all felt that way. It's an amazing quality.
And this affection that people have, misplaced, I think, in
yes,
its extreme, produces what I call the Leflon effect. And I don't know if I shared this with you in our previous conversation.
No, I love it already. Tell me.
But, you know, Reagan was the Teflon president, and it was Patsy Schroeder who tagged him with that name. We want to give her credit, the former congresswoman from Colorado.
I loved her.
And so when Obama became president, my theory is that he went to DuPont, and they developed the new and improved Leflon. And that means that nothing that comes from the left sticks to him. And it's partly facilitated by projection and this extreme affection that people have, that he's the good guy, and he can expand presidential power. He can assert secrecy where it didn't exist before. He can continue to wiretap every phone call in the United States and intercept every email because he's a good guy. But they don't really sit back and say, well, what if President Perry attempted to use these same powers? Would you feel the same way?
No, and this is exactly what we're talking about. The hard light, the cold light of day involves facing facts, that we've had a destructive regime for 8 years, and that Obama, in wanting to turn the page, is continuing that destructiveness. It's going to go on, and then there will be a Rick Perry. I guarantee it. Somebody worse than Bush becoming president, because the original basic fundamental fractures and the fundamental disruptions in our society have not been addressed. And they need to be discussed, and they need to be brought out into the daylight, and Obama wants to turn the page. Mm-hmm. I agree with that. It's a very problematic thing. I think that he's counting on the fact nobody's going to vote for Mitt Romney. I'm not. The question is whether people are going to give him money or stay home. But I'm never going to vote for somebody like even Mitt Romney, let alone Perry. I can't imagine it. Mm-hmm. And I do want to vote because I feel like it's wrong not to.
Now, Dr. Frank, I want to ask you about something that we discussed the last time you and I spoke while you were working on Obama on the Couch. And that is the reaction I had the third time I heard him speak, which was at the stadium in Denver, his acceptance of the Democratic nomination. And this was on the 40th anniversary of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. But he couldn't bring himself to actually mention Martin Luther King by name. He referred just obliquely to a preacher. And fast forward to the recent events where they dedicated the MLK Memorial in Washington. Between these posts, we haven't seen him identify as a black man, much less a black president. And I'd like your analysis about the traits and the experiences he had growing up that have enabled him to become the first president of color while not really presenting himself as a full black man who is part of a black community.
Well, one of the things that's very obvious is that he is a post-protest person. He did not grow up in the South. He did not grow up. He does not sound like Jesse Jackson. He does not sound like Al Sharpton. He didn't grow up with that fighting sense of solidarity. He doesn't have any of that. He is like a Hyde Park liberal, looking like that, although I don't even think he's as liberal as Adlai Stevenson. But because he's black, he can really, because he's so much half black and half white, he can completely endear himself to white groups when he's with whites, black groups when he's with blacks, because he has different self states. But your question about where Martin Luther King comes in, I've been struggling with that ever since you asked me that, believe it or not. I've thought about that a lot. I was just talking to my sister about it the other day. And what became clear to me as I was talking with her is that the only thing I could finally think of is that he doesn't want to be responsible for his daughters growing up without a father. And that if he became too radical or too much like Martin Luther King, there are so many people who would like nothing better than to assassinate him. It's already, you know, he's had more death threats than any president in history. I think that he really doesn't want his daughters to be orphans the way he was. I mean, he is so devoted to that. But I think that it's, again, an example of his compromising other principles, and I can understand the conflict. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to answer that.
Yeah. Dr. Frank, again, your analysis of Barack Obama is not based on any personal contact with the president.
No.
But how would you appraise his mental health? What is your sense of his health in terms of a psychiatrist's view?
I actually think that he can learn from experience, but it's not easy. I used to feel about his mental health was, and I wrote in my book, that he's basically psychologically sound, and I felt he was sound. But basically, the bipartisan disorder verges on, as I wrote and you read, an idée fixée. It's like it's a fixed idea, and that's delusional. It's delusional to think he can play golf with John Boehner and change his mind. It's delusional. It's not sane.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say he's psychotic in the traditional sense of hearing voices or, you know, any of that, but I don't think he gets certain things about these people. And the Republicans see that. They say, what they say, he doesn't get it about Ahmadinejad, and we're saying he doesn't get it about John Boehner,
both
of whom are out to destroy him.
Then let me issue a caveat that you give in the book, and you referenced it a little earlier, that you have slight discomfort because you have published this book in after he's only been in office for 2.5 years, and a great deal more can happen. But let me put this to you, and again, this is not asking for a political assessment, but a psychological, psychiatric one. There are many people I know who say, well, I know he hasn't come through for us in his first term, but if we reelect him, he'll be liberated. He'll be able to do whatever he wants. And I'm going to put aside the political factors that he's likely to lose control of the Senate and is unlikely to regain control of the House. But putting those aside, is the speculation that people have that he would be freed from some of the self-imposed restrictions of his first term if reelected, do you consider that realistic?
No. In a simple word, no. It makes no sense psychologically. That's essentially saying that the only things that are holding him back are externals. He is being held back by very deep issues that he does not want to face and does not want to deal with, which involves involve direct conflict with authority people, which involves facing the fact that he didn't have such a great childhood, which involves facing rage and facing his fear of abandonment. And until he does that, he'll have obsessive bipartisan disorder. And I see no change in his second term. At the first, when I first worked on the book, when I was a little bit more starry-eyed, I felt that the treatment recommendation would be the repeal of the 22nd Amendment, namely that the two-term limit is the problem, that he needs to have an unlimited number of election possibilities, so he would then be able to flex his muscles. But now that I have gotten to know him better, I don't even think that would do the trick. At the same time, he has, I think, I know his book is, my book is inside the White House. It's inside the White House gates. I got it in. And it's there. And the director of communications has it. What he's going to do with it, I don't know. But he does have it, and he's a major friend of close person to Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking that in the last week or two, Obama started actually doing some of the things that were recommended in the book, namely naming names, calling Boehner out by name, calling McConnell out by name, and doing the kinds of things that are really necessary to start labeling and identifying people who are out to destroy him. He has a long way to go because he has to look at the fact that he needs to name himself in terms of his relationship. He doesn't have to do it in public, but somewhere, to his own family, and has to face things about his own family of origin. Unless he does that, I don't see there will be a big change in the second term. I just, even if he got all Democrats in both houses, he makes deals. And I think he's partly politically conservative and middle of the road, or he's like a Republican, you know, the old-style Republican, the Lowell Weicker types of Republicans. But at the same time, I mean, that's his politics.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that he also is so obsessed with turning the page and not looking at certain things that I don't see him getting things done.
Dr. Justin A. Frank, thank you for a wonderful conversation. I really enjoyed the book, and I wholeheartedly recommend it to my listeners. It's Inside the Mind of the President, Obama on the Couch.
Thank you.
And now a quick comment from Will Durst, the San Francisco stand-up comic and sit-down commentator. Take it away, Will.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here with a few random thoughts on our nation's capital. You always hear people say the problem with this country is Washington. But don't hate the player, hate the game. The people in Washington are normal. Okay, semi-normal. All right. The inmates have not only taken over the asylum, they somehow managed to put the most criminally insane in charge. It's a work-free drug zone, the Florence of Malfeasance, the largest Superfund site in America, where they invented double-sided red tape and use it like it's going out of style. You know that box they're always telling us to think outside of? Well, the Beltway is it. And the worst place in the world to ask for directions. Because nobody has a clue as to where they are, but they all live in mortal fear of blowing their cover, so pretend to have all the answers and will go out of their way to confuse you just to stay in practice. JFK said D.C. combined all the hospitality of the North with the efficiency of the South, not to mention the scruples of a turkey vulture overlooking a yard full of wounded bunnies. It's a place where you always have to worry that your best friend is wearing a wire. And then the politicians get all oblivious as to why the world holds them in such low esteem, even though every election they spend millions of dollars convincing us what despicable crooks their opponents are, not realizing that the only time we trust them is when they tell us that the other guy is lying. And like Hotel California, you can check in, but you can never leave, because after spending more than a couple of years in D.C., you're ruined and can never go back to living with normal people. But hey, a person has to live somewhere, right? Even lobbyists. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
Hey, thanks for joining us for this therapeutic session of the Peter B. Collins Show. I hope it enhanced your understanding of the 44th president. Send me an email. I'd love it.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.